It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up on Central Time, our guest explains how last month's John Doe ruling in Wisconsin could affect national campaign finance laws.
First, there have been a couple of recent news stories about businesses and government officials denying goods and services to same-sex couples based on their religious beliefs.
A state appeals court in Colorado ruled that a baker couldn't cite his religious beliefs in refusing to make wedding cakes for same-sex couples. And in Kentucky, a county clerk has refused to administer any marriage licenses, gay or straight couples.
We're joined today by Douglas Laycock, professor of constitutional law in the University of Virginia Law School. Douglas, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Well, now that same-sex marriage is legal, can you lay out the new legal arguments surfacing around people who refuse to provide goods or services to same-sex couples?
Well, I don't know anyone who refuses to provide goods and services to same-sex couples as a general matter. What people are doing is refusing to serve the wedding. Because I think for a lot of religious conservatives, a marriage is inherently a religious relationship. The wedding is a religious event. And in their view, it's a sacrilegious event. It's a prohibited religious event. And the job of these wedding vendors, the wedding planner, the caterer, even the cake maker, to help make this the best and most memorable wedding it can be. They are promoting it, and they say they can't do that. That's the claim, and it's much narrower than simply not serving same-sex couples. I think it's a pretty sympathetic claim, but so far, none of these small businesses in the wedding industry, none of them has won an exemption from a discrimination lawsuit.
So what have the courts found so far as we look at cases like these?
Well, mostly the courts say that there's a compelling government interest in the non-discrimination laws, even if other bakers, other wedding planners are immediately available nearby. The New Mexico Supreme Court said the Religious Freedom Restoration Act didn't even apply when you were sued by a private citizen. These cases have all arisen in blue or purple states. They don't come up in red states because red states don't have gay rights laws.
Well, what you're describing is a fault line between religious beliefs or religious liberty and anti-discrimination law. So how is that being played out? Do you see it?
Well, the way it ought to be played out is that we protect the liberty of all Americans. We protect the right of gay couples to get married and have as big a wedding as they want, and we should protect the right of religious conservatives not to have to participate or assist with that wedding. But that's not how it's played out so far. The way it's played out so far is that the religious folks have lost every one of these cases. It was almost inevitable in Colorado. The Colorado courts are pretty seriously hostile to religious liberty. There are appeals still pending, but they've lost a case in Oregon. They've lost a case in Washington State. Those are both very blue states and very secular states. And they lost a case in New Mexico.
So do you believe that religious beliefs, religious liberties should trump anti-discrimination law?
That's not what I said. I said there should be exceptions in these very narrow contexts. There should be exceptions in religious contexts. We don't make the church itself do weddings, and I don't think we should make these very small businesses do weddings either. They understand the wedding to be a religious event.
So is it an act of harm, as some supporters of these rulings have talked about, if, say, a baker does not want to provide a cake for this wedding? Does it be tantamount to harm, as we're talking
about? Well, it would be a very rare case where they have to do without a cake. If we're in some isolated rural area and there's no other baker, then I would say they got to provide the cake. The harm the gay rights side mostly points to is emotional harm. They're insulted. They're offended. And I think that's real. But there's an equal or greater emotional harm on the religious side. They've disrupted their relationship with God, which is the most important relationship in their lives. We're in a pluralistic society where there's a lot of mutual disapproval. Religious folks think the gay rights, the gay people are sinning. The gay rights people think the religious folks are hateful bigots. They disapprove of each other, and the gay couples cannot be entirely sheltered from the fact that there are people who disapprove of them.
We're talking to constitutional law professor Douglas Laycock from the University of Virginia. We're taking a look at the latest legal fault lines between religious liberty and anti-discrimination laws as regards same-sex couples and same-sex marriage in general. And now we've been talking about private businesses so far. Let's turn to the Kentucky case with a government official there not wanting to issue marriage licenses. What do you make of that one?
Well, that's completely different because she is exercising the authority and power of the state of Kentucky. Kentucky doesn't have a religion. It's not entitled to religious exemptions. The Supreme Court's decision doesn't apply to private parties. It only applies to states. They have to issue licenses. The county clerk doesn't have to do it personally, but someone in her office has to issue marriage licenses. So she's clearly going to lose, and there's really not much to argue about there.
Well, how do you see this unfolding as we go forward? These cases, maybe not the Kentucky one, but if you want to go back to the case of the baker, these are moving through the courts, this kind of argument. How do you see it progressing?
Well, it seems pretty clear that the religious side has been losing in blue and purple states and will probably continue to do so. I think the path ahead is at the federal level and in red states. There's no gay rights law at the federal level. No gay rights law in most red states. So gay couples are completely unprotected there. And it's hard to imagine those states enacting gay rights laws without religious exemptions. So there's a legislative way to provide strong protection for gays and also exemptions for religious conservatives, and Utah just did that. They didn't complete the job. They didn't do public accommodations. They only did employment and housing. But it's an important start. It should be a model for the country. Unfortunately, it's been denounced by both sides. The gay rights folks say it's only Utah. It's not a model for anywhere. And the Republicans are unhappy that they passed it. This is another example of the political polarization in the country. The Republicans don't want the gay rights law, and the Democrats don't want the religious exemptions. And so we're, on this issue, like so many others, we're in gridlock.
So are you saying that states should pass religious liberty laws?
They should pass gay rights laws, and they should pass religious liberty laws, yes.
Douglas, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to do it.
That was Douglas Laycock from the University of Virginia. He's a law professor there. He joined us for a look at the latest legal fault lines between religious liberty and anti-discrimination laws. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
We're talking about last month's John Doe ruling from the state Supreme Court and the impact that case could have nationwide.
In mid-July, the state Supreme Court ruled that state laws against coordination between political campaigns and issue advocacy groups were vague and unconstitutional. That ruling ended investigations into Governor Walker's recall election campaign.
Last week, the investigation special prosecutor asked the state Supreme Court to reconsider the ruling and may pursue it up to the United States Supreme Court.
We're joined now by Robert Federici. He's a money and politics reporter for ProPublica. Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So this was here in Wisconsin, but you say this could maybe set a precedent, or your the people you interviewed in your piece said that this could set a precedent nationwide. How so?
So yeah, that's the big unanswered question moving forward. How this might ripple across Wisconsin's borders. One way, according to the experts I talked to, is that it could spark attempts to overturn similar laws in other states that restrict coordination. A couple of prominent conservative activists I talked to predicted that, these sorts of challenges would take time, but that they are coming. And then the other way is if, the special prosecutor makes the decision to appeal this to the U.S. Supreme Court, and if the Supreme Court decides to hear it, which is a big if, it could give, a court that's already loosened the reins on political money a chance to do that again. The outcome could go in one of two directions, assuming that the appeal focuses on the coordination facet. Some experts are predicting it could be the next Citizens United. It could basically, eviscerate campaign contribution limits nationwide. Others are predicting that, though the Roberts Court has generally ruled to loosen political money regulations, They've done so on the rationale that these independent groups that can accept donations of unlimited size are truly independent. So they'd be reluctant to loosen coordination restrictions given that past rationale.
And this idea of coordination is at the heart of, the John Doe 2 investigation and your piece. What do we mean when we talk about coordination here?
So basically what the justices in Wisconsin signaled is that, politicians and independent groups can work together in most contexts, as long as their ads don't explicitly advocate for a vote for or against. So basically they can run ads supporting or bashing a candidate, but they can't coordinate if they're explicitly advocating a vote for or against the candidate, for or against Scott Walker, or for or against someone else. So it's a pretty, academic distinction. I mean, you could run an ad saying, hey, Scott Walker is the greatest, but you can't say vote for him.
And so in that instance, as long as that third-party group doesn't say vote for or against a particular candidate, if I'm a candidate, my campaign can call that group up on the phone. We can coordinate our mission, our messaging. I, as the candidate, could encourage donors to donate to that group. All those kind of coordination under this Wisconsin ruling is okay now, where a lot of times in the past it was perceived and treated as not legal.
Right. So what critics of the ruling are saying is that, for all intents and purposes, this, makes contribution limits moot because now individuals, instead of donating a max amount, which is relatively small to, directly to the campaign, instead they can donate, unlimited sums to these independent groups that are closely aligned with the candidates they favor.
And are there other states, even if this didn't go to the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court right away, are there other states that might be ripe to change their laws in similar ways here?
Yeah, a few states have been mentioned. I mean, what's important to remember is it's not just Republicans pushing to expand the boundaries of coordination law. So in Connecticut, the Democratic Governors Association has filed a lawsuit basically challenging the way they restrict their independent political expenditures. And what they wanted was an injunction that would have kept the state agency, the relevant state agency, from stopping them from coordinate with the campaign of the Democratic governor there. And the reason for their concern is that governor had been a major fundraiser for their group. So if they do work with him and spend in a way that's favorable to him, they were worried they'd be accused of illegal coordination. So their hope is to be able to quash that preemptively.
And so the fear, as you started to touch on earlier, from opponents of money in politics, people want money in politics out of here, is that this could open another set of floodgates to let more money into politics. What are their worst fears if this became the law of the land nationwide?
Well, it's exactly that. It's that, for all intents and purposes, campaign contributions won't really exist anymore. Instead of donating directly to a candidate, you just donate to one of these independent groups that, some of them disclose their donors, some of them don't have to, but all of them can accept donations of a limited size. And as far as the candidate is concerned, the argument goes it doesn't make a difference because they know who the money's coming from.
Talking to Robert Federici from ProPublica about how the recent state Supreme Court ruling here in Wisconsin on the second John Doe investigation might change campaign finance laws around the country, especially when it comes to coordination between a candidate's campaign and so-called third-party issue groups, ones that don't say vote for or against a candidate, but can do almost anything but that in their messaging. So this could change things a lot, as you mentioned, if it goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. What's the thinking on whether the U.S. Supreme Court wants to tackle these issues?
So it's a big if. The biggest argument against them hearing it is the fact that there's no circuit split, and oftentimes that is what the Supreme Court looks for when they decide whether or not to hear a case. Another big if is whether the special prosecutor, Francis Schmitz, is going to, ask the U.S. Supreme Court to look at it. A lot of people saw what he did recently in asking the Wisconsin court to reconsider the conflict of interest issue for the judges. They saw that as a signal that he did eventually want to take it up with the Supreme Court, but not on the coordination front. Instead, on this idea that a couple of the justices in Wisconsin should have recused themselves because their campaigns had been supported by some of the same groups that were part of the John Doe probe.
So it's possible that if that chain of events happens and this is brought and taken up by the U.S. Supreme Court, but only on the grounds of the issue of recusal, it might go to the U.S. Supreme Court, but not resolve and not expand this coordination ruling.
Right. Yeah. If it's appealed on that front, it'll be pretty difficult for the U.S. Supreme Court to make a ruling that relates to coordination. But nonetheless, it would be interesting. I mean, the groups that were part of the probe that the justices halted in Wisconsin, were estimated to have spent millions backing the campaigns of two of the justices. It'd be interesting to see what they thought about those two justices not recusing themselves. But, it would likely not provide any sort of new national-level clarification on how independent groups and candidates can coordinate.
Let's get into the arguments that lay behind this and a lot of other campaign finance issues. First of all, the people who are opposed to more money in politics say, in effect, more money equals corruption, or at least the perception of corruption. Is that argument coming up on this coordination issue?
Well, the argument on that side is that contribution limits exist for a reason, so that, no one person or no one group can have extreme influence over a particular candidate. So if they can only donate $2,500, $2,700, $5,200 for a couple, the limits change over time. They can't have that much of an impact. The candidate, the eventual elected official won't be that indebted to any one person or one group. But the argument goes that if these donors can just donate, $1 million more to a group that is working closely with the candidate, supports the candidate, and the candidate is aware who donated that money, it really makes no difference. On the other side are folks who think that when the government restricts how much you can donate to a candidate or to a political group or how a political group can coordinate with the candidate, what they're basically doing is restricting free speech. And they get very nervous about the idea of the government going in and restricting such a fundamental right and, launching investigations like the John Doe investigation in Wisconsin that look into these sorts of free speech issues. So, the folks on both sides are very passionate about where they're coming from, and one side is basically arguing the free speech argument, and the other side is pushing the corruption idea.
And that free speech argument, the political speech argument, definitely came up from conservative groups here in Wisconsin, as you say, the ones that were targeted in the John Doe probe. Did we hear similar arguments from that Democratic governor's group you mentioned in working in Connecticut?
Well, what's been interesting to me is that this is an issue that's often broken down between left and right. But when you look at the political leanings of the people involved on both sides, you'll often see a mix. Some of the folks who are the biggest advocates of tighter restrictions on money in politics are Republicans. You'll even see some folks on the other side who, have the liberal leaning. So it's not so much a left-right issue, in my experience.
And it seems like the last barrier here may be that outside group and whether they can say vote for or against a candidate and still and not have any restrictions on them. Are we getting close to that point where it's more or less anything goes? You can say what you want, get money from who you want, coordinate with who you want?
It is not there on the national level, but the idea is that if the special prosecutor in Wisconsin does decide to appeal and does decide to go the coordination route, and if the Supreme Court decides to hear the case, that could be the potential. I mean, that's sort of the biggest fear among folks who want more regulation over money in politics, that what was decided in Wisconsin could be translated to politics on the national level.
One question that comes up in these issues is disclosure. If I donate to a candidate, they have to reveal that I donated to them. A lot of these third-party groups, they do not. Is there a movement to say, okay, we'll let this money in there, we'll allow this coordination as long as we know where the donations came from?
Right. So, I mean, that was one of the arguments the Supreme Court made. But what we've learned is that in a lot of circumstances, you can't figure out who's behind the money. So, super PACs, for example, are typically considered transparent on that front. You know, they have to disclose who their donors are. But in some circumstances, for example, if the donor donates through an LLC, and that LLC is registered in a state where it's difficult to find out who the actual person behind it was, you know, it's hard to track where that money came from. If the money comes through one of these politically active nonprofits, these C4s, they do not have to disclose who their donors were.
Robert, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, alrighty. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Robert Fattorucci, money and politics reporter with ProPublica, talking about how Wisconsin's John Doe ruling could affect campaign finance laws.
I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Food Friday, and we're in that magical part of summer now, and all kinds of food are coming into season. If you're in Door County, that means one thing, cherries. The harvest began a few weeks back, and it's starting to wrap up, but there's still plenty of time to make the most of this year's crop.
And according to our next guest, there's plenty more you can do with cherries than just throwing them in a pie, and she has some great ideas for working cherries into our summer cooking.
Terry Milligan is with us now. She's a chef and culinary instructor in Door County. Terry, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Well, we think about cherries as something that you see used in a pie, for instance. That's your fallback, the good old all-American cherry pie. But we can do a lot more with cherries, can't we?
You certainly can. And I'm from Door County, as you mentioned. So our cherries up here are the Montmorency cherries, which are the sour cherries. But I don't think that they're real, real sour. They have a little sweetness to them, but they call them sour cherries. And having been a chef up in Door County for over 20 years, I've cooked with cherries for many years and in a variety of ways. So I do use cherries in everything from ketchup to desserts like a pie, but other things as well. And as accompaniments, I make a terrific nectarine cherry salsa. I also use it as an accompaniment with chicken, pork, duck breast, and you can make a nice cherry sauce with some nice red wine for those things.
Yeah, what kind of flavors mix well with cherries? We're using them as a sauce.
Well, with the sauce, wine goes great with cherries. So the recipe that I have listed on my website shows it being served with duck, but as I said, use it with pork, even salmon. But red wine, specifically like a Pinot Noir, would work really well because that has the nice flavors that go well with the cherries and they complement each other. So that's a nice wine to go with any sort of cherry sauce.
Now, you said that you're from Door County, so you know about the association and the role that cherries have there, but give us a sense, how important are cherries to that region?
Well, cherries are our number one crop here in Door County, and in Door County, 99% of all the cherries from Wisconsin come from our county. There's a few little cherry orchards right over the border, but we have the majority of cherries, so we have 2,500 acres of cherry orchards in Door County, so it's a very big part of our industrial crop.
I know things can be hit or miss sometimes with cherries or any crop when it comes to the weather. How did this year's cherry harvest go?
Well, actually, this year's was a really big crop. The year before, we've had years where we haven't had great crops, and what happens in those years, it's usually something has occurred during the time those blossoms are not when they're out, but it's when the blossoms form. that they might get a frost and then you have problems with it, or heavy weather that's damaging them. But this year was a great year for cherries. So we had a bumper crop of cherries this year.
Now, the thing about cherries, they're delicious, but I think of them as sort of a high-maintenance fruit because they've got that pit that you have to get rid of. And I know some friends who swear by, you know, the device known as a cherry pitter. Is it necessary, and what is the easiest way to do this thing?
Well, I actually just did a class on cherries at the Milwaukee Public Market, and I had about 6 pounds of cherries that I did have to pit. And I did use that cherry pitter that everyone talks about that goes on top of a ball can, and it really does work great. But if you live in Door County, you're going to find some old-school folks that actually just use a bobby pin, not like a curved bobby pin, but like a straight bobby pin, and they can pop them right out.
A bobby pin? Like that, yeah. You can buy at the drugstore?
Yeah. So, I mean, you could do it, but you've got to be pretty good.
I was going to say.
For $9 or $8, you can get the thing that goes on top of the ball jar. And it's nice because the pits go right down in there. Hmm. Now, I will fess up that I did miss a few pits. If
Uh-oh.
Anyone is listening who was in that class, they will tell you I missed a few pits. I gave away a prize if they found a pit, and I had to give a couple prizes away.
Yeah, I will say I've got a tart cherry tree in my front yard. I harvest some. I freeze some. I would use a lot more if it weren't for the processing of, I just use a knife. I guess I'm really backward in that.
I'm
and it's messy, too.
A knife also, but then it kind of mars the look of the cherry, you know? Mm. So you unless you're really good and you can pop them out quick. But when you use those little devices, they come out really, it looks just like a cherry. It doesn't look like the pit's still in there, but it's nice and formed.
We're talking with Terry Milligan right now, chef and culinary instructor from Door County, talking about cooking with cherries. The Door County cherry harvest is in. In fact, it's going to be wrapping up pretty soon. So we're talking about what to do with all this delicious fruit. And Terry, if my ears are not deceiving me, you mentioned a cherry ketchup.
I did. Mm-hmm. And I,
what is that like?
I just made a batch of cherry ketchup a couple of weeks ago with the first cherries that came in. And that, you do have to pit the cherries. That takes some time. But you could also, if you're in Door County or even outside of the county, a lot of times you can find cherries pitted that are frozen. So that helps those of you that can't be in Door County for the five or six weeks of cherry season. You can still use cherries by getting them frozen. But it's a terrific recipe that I actually served last Tuesday in my class on a turkey burger. And it has a little sweetness in it, but it also has a little tartness in it from some vinegar. And then some unusual spices. It had cardamom in it, cinnamon and nutmeg and allspice.
And is there also tomato sauce of some sort, or does the cherry take the place?
Ketchup does not have to be tomato-based.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
That's just, in fact, I work for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and do food writing, and I had to do a ketchup article a while ago. So ketchup actually started in Asia, and it was a fermented fish sauce.
Oh,
so
wow.
It was just a sauce to put, just what you wanted to hear on a cherry segment. but ketchup can be anything that is a fruit or even a vegetable. I've done rhubarb rhubarb ketchup in the spring, but it's just pureed. It's almost like a chutney flavor, but pureed.
And so what else do you use it on? You mentioned a burger, so obviously you're going savory with this, not sweet. Could you use it with any kind of meat?
You could. It goes well with a hamburger also, but also I've used it on salmon, grilled salmon or grilled chicken or grilled pork. All of those work well.
Now, we've got this sour cherry ketchup. We have a lot of recipes. You gave us a bumper crop of cherry recipes. You can get to them. They're linked on the Central Time Facebook page. So that's one, the sour cherry ketchup. Does not require tomatoes. I've learned something new today. Ketchup doesn't have to be tomato.
Tomatoes didn't come into ketchup land until about the 30s when Heinz developed ketchup. Before that, there was no tomatoes in ketchup.
All right, so there's the ketchup. Now, we've got one that is either an appetizer or a dessert, Pinot Noir cherry soup. I would not have come up with that combination on my own, I promise you. Tell us about this one.
Well, I had a restaurant for many years, and this was a very popular soup that we did. We served it for a first course a lot of times, and it has, again, it's got a little bit of sweetness, but because those cherries are sour and you've got that Pinot Noir wine in it, it's not, I wouldn't call it a sweet, sweet soup. But we always would garnish it, as a picture on my website has it, with a little piece of mint. If we wanted to do it for dessert, we'd serve it with a little scoop of either vanilla ice cream, or I like to put lemon sorbet on top as well. So it was a different type of dessert for you as well.
Oh, wow. Who knew cherries could do all these versatile things? This is sort of mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
So there is also, this is a little more simple for those of us who aren't quite ready to go down some of these fancier roads. Cherries is a salad ingredient. What do you like about that?
Well, cherries can be added both dried and fresh into into salads. So I have a salsa recipe on my website, which is can be used as an accompaniment with a salad. But I also I pickle cherries sometimes, the fresh cherries, and you can can them or use them directly, and you can put those in a salad. And pickling them just means that you're going to put a little bit of, again, sweet and sour on there, and let them ferment for about 15 minutes to 30 minutes. And you've got a little sweet sour cherry you can put on your salads, or I've also used them as an accompaniment with a drink.
Now, wait a minute. What does a pickled cherry end up tasting like? Because I think of pickling, you know, pickles and olives.
But it's got a little more sweetness than a pickle.
Uh-huh.
Well, pickles have a little sweetness,
sure,
too, if you get a sweet pickle. So what I usually do is a little bit of the vinegar, and I use a nice white wine vinegar, a little bit of honey or sugar, and then I put some savory things in, like ground fennel, even ground rosemary, so it gets a little bit of an herb flavor as well. And I have lots of folks that will put a couple of those little pickled cherries on a skewer and put them in a cocktail.
Ooh.
Wow. Is there anything you haven't done with cherries, Terry? I'm starting to think we haven't hit the limit here.
Well, if you live in Door County, you're continually coming up with things to do with cherries.
We're talking right now with chef and culinary instructor Terry Milligan about cooking with cherries. The Door County cherry harvest season is here, coming to a close. Now we're getting advice on what to do with all that cherries. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234.
And we want to hear your recipes, your ideas, and maybe your questions. Do you stick with, with desserts, the pies, the cobblers? What's your secret? Or do you get more creative with them, as our guest does? Maybe you just like eating them. That's okay, too. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. It's Food Friday, and we're talking about cherries and how to cook with them. Our guest is Door County chef and culinary instructor Terry Milligan. She knows a lot about cherries, and we're learning a lot from her. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234.
Do you enjoy baking or cooking with cherries? What sorts of things do you use them for? What questions do you have our guest about cherry-related cuisine? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Find a link to a bunch of recipes from Terry while you're there. We'll go right to our callers. We've got Doug on the line now in Appleton. Doug, hi.
Hi.
What do you got for us, Doug?
I was in a barbecue competition class at Fox Valley Technical College this spring, and I used cherries and blueberries, and I simmered them in vinegar and then blended it up, and then I had a chinois, but you can use a cheesecloth if you'd like. Drain that out, reduce it, and then I had a wine reduction going too, and I put a little wine in there, and then I thickened it with some sugar. And it was a great barbecue sauce. I thought it was really good. I did not do well in the competition, but
so
that is another story.
And what did you put this cherry-flavored barbecue sauce on?
You could use it for ribs. That's what I designed it for, but I was given chicken, and that was a good, nice flavors together with the barbecue chicken.
All right, Doug, better luck winning the competition next year. But that sounds great, a barbecue sauce with cherries cooked down. Sound like a few steps along the way there, Terry.
I was impressed with a chinois. But that sounded like a great recipe, kind of similar to, for listeners who want to do it with a little less work, the cherry ketchup is kind of on that same vein, and you could just spice it up a little bit.
Well, thanks a lot for that call, Doug. Appreciate that. And Terry, you had mentioned this recipe for cherry and nectarine salsa. How does that one come together?
Well, that is one of the easiest ones. So that you're basically just chopping your nectarines. You could use some other stone fruit, too. Peaches work well, or plums. And then the infamous pitted cherries. What I like to do is actually slice the cherries in half after I pit them. Then I know there's no pits in them. And I just toss it with the nectarines, and I add a little fresh mint usually, and then things that you usually put into a salsa, a jalapeno pepper chopped up, some red pepper chopped up, some red onion or white onion chopped up, and a little bit of lime juice, a nice squeeze of a couple of limes on there, and you've got a nice little salsa that's a little different that you could serve. It actually goes great on tacos, fish tacos.
And this one I knew. Salsa does not have to have tomatoes in it.
No, salsa does not have to have tomatoes.
We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Sandy is with us in Waukesha. Sandy, hi.
Hi. I am calling to share with your guest and listener a Door County cherry recipe that I grew up on. Every year when we vacationed in Fish Creek, we would all go cherry picking, and my grandmother would sit at the table and pit every cherry with a hairpin.
There you go.
The old-fashioned hairpin that held up her buns. And with those cherries, she made cherry soup. And it was the highlight of the vacation. And this cherry soup, she obviously cooked it over the stove. However, it was served cold. And no, it wasn't. It was served warm. What am I thinking of? But the unusual ingredient in this, and I don't know if it's the German tradition, is it had the cherries, and she used heavy cream, I'm sure. But she also had dumplings, and they were just delicious. And we just could eat it every day of our vacation. I don't know if you've heard of such a use for your cherries. All of her daughters have tried to replicate the recipe, and no one has come close to my grandma.
Oh, thank you so much for that, Sandy. So it almost sounds like a soup version of cherry cobbler. You got the cherries, the liquidy cherries, and dumplings in them. Have you heard of that? Cherry soup with dumplings?
I've heard of it with dumplings. With cream, yes. I've heard of adding the cream to the soup, but not the dumplings. And that's an interesting twist on that.
So it sounds like that's a dessert soup with cherries, right? Or did it sound savory?
Well, I think that could have been savory, too. It depends on how they flavored the soup. Knowing the Germans, it might have been like a borscht-type thing, where it was just instead of beets, they used the sour cherries. That's what I'm thinking.
Wow. Well, we should talk about cherries as a dessert vehicle because they are so good sweet. We know about cherry pies, but how do you like to serve cherries when you're going for dessert?
Well, there are so many things you can do with cherries for dessert. I have on my website a couple of things. One is a plum and cherry tart, so instead of doing a cherry pie, I make it into a tart form. I also make a pie, and up here in Door County, it's a pretty familiar pie called bumbleberry. And though cherries are not a berry, we in Door County throw it in as one of our berries. The bumbleberry is not a specific berry. Some people think there's an actual bumbleberry. It just means that it's a bumble of berries. So we put in whatever kind of berry you want, and then we add cherries to it as well. So that's a little kind of a different take on a traditional cherry pie. So that's a great way to use the cherries. I also wanted to mention on Door County, their site, the Visitors Bureau site, they have an actual page devoted to cherries and to recipes. And on there, they've got a great recipe from Al Johnson's that is a bread pudding with cherries. And that's a nice kind of easier way to work with cherries without having to make a crust and a pie crust. You can just do the bread pudding.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Terry Milligan, Door County chef, about cooking with cherries. Now, every week there's one recipe I feel like where it's like, why am I not eating that right now? This week is the one you gave us for Door County cherry. I don't know how to pronounce it. Clafoutis?
Clafouti.
This looked like what? It's like a baked pancake packed with cherries. It looked great.
And I've got to tell you, I think you could make this because it's really easy. you just need to make a batter, and you can do it in a food processor, a blender, or in a bowl, and you pour it into a hot, I use a cast iron skillet, but a cast iron skillet, the cherries, and the batter, and that's it. And you put it in your oven for about 25, 30 minutes, and it puffs up. It's, and it looks, if you're familiar with the Dutch baby type German pancake, it's a, kind of a French version of that. It originated in the Normandy region of France, and that's where there are a lot of sour cherry trees. So originally, the recipe, you would like this, and you didn't have to pit the cherries.
Really?
They originally
just
had
spit them out?
Spit them. In it. But I don't know. Those French are a little crazy.
Yeah.
But I prefer to use the pitted cherries in it.
I think I would, too. I love clafoutis, although I thought it was pronounced clafoutis. I learned something today.
Oh, you probably say that. Yours sounds much more elegant.
I don't know, but apparently incorrect. But do you, what do you put on this? Do you put some whipped cream, or is it...
You can put whipped cream, powdered sugar on it. If you're doing it as a breakfast type item, I would just sprinkle a little powdered sugar on it. But a nice scoop of vanilla ice cream or whipped cream is great on it.
A la mode pancakes can never go wrong. Charlie in Milwaukee, I don't have time to ring him on, but he's bringing up the Wisconsin classic, the cherry mash, using it with club soda or mixed drinks. Any tips on that, Terry?
Well, you can put one of those pickled cherries in there. I've got to tell you, I am not a drinker, so I don't make that. I make the wines, but not the mash. So I'm not a good person to ask about that. So I apologize.
That's
for not
okay.
Having to, able to help him on that.
Any final words of inspiration for us as we maybe cook with some cherries this weekend, Terry?
Well, my one word of inspiration is that it's almost the end of our season. So if you're up in the Door County area, you can still find some cherries that have been picked and are at some of our farm markets. But in Wisconsin and in Milwaukee at the fair, if you still have a couple of days to go to the fair, in the Wisconsin Pavilion, we've got five or six of our cherry producers down there with cherry products. So there's a way to taste the cherries if you're at the state fair.
Terry,
other than that, just cook with cherries and love them.
Thank you so much. Great recipes. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Terry Milligan, Door County chef and culinary instructor, joining us to talk about cooking with cherries. A lot of cherry recipes, including the sour cherry ketchup, linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Sesame Street is moving to a new neighborhood, partly. The long-running kids show is on PBS, and it'll stay there, but it's also going to have a home on HBO, according to an announcement this week.
As part of the deal, new episodes will air first on HBO, then later on PBS. There's been a little bit of concern about the deal. While it will bring more production money to Children's Television Workshop, the creator of Sesame Street, critics say it's a bad idea to have episodes on a paid service.
There has been a history of crossover from HBO to Sesame Street, including Grover in the Game of Thrones knockoff, a musical chairs-themed contest called A Game of Chairs.
We have one, two, three players and one, two, three chairs.
Three chairs and three players.
Can we hurry this up? I have a wedding to get to.
Oh, right. Remove one of the chairs.
Ah, yes. Removing one of the chairs.
And for fans of the show, that was a Robb Stark-inspired character who had to get to a wedding. Yes, they went there.
Yeah, it's HBO and Sesame Street, kind of different audiences for some of the different programming. It could be weird disjuncture. Somebody pointed out that Sesame Street and The Sopranos would be next to each other alphabetically on HBO listings.
It's a brave new world in which we live.
Yeah, so Sesame Street is still available, of course, with our friends on Wisconsin Public Television. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.